Hi, welcome back with Truth News on the 28th of June 2012. That's, of course, Australian time. To our listeners in the US, we wish you a great week. I hope that your world is less painful than ours. We've got, in Australia, we have some really unpleasant things unfolding right at the moment. We actually have the carbon tax due to be passed into law long ago, but now it is actually due to go into effect. And it actually will be all happening within a few days' time. It starts on the 1st of July. Now, there are some incredible things about the carbon tax. One of the most incredible of all is the $1 million fines that the Labor Party has managed to get through, Labor Party being the governing party here, and it's spelled L-A-B-O-R. The Labor Party has managed to get these $1 million fines passed through in legislation to anyone who displays anti-carbon tax posters, which they claim would be misleading. And the opposition have, of course, produced a lot of these posters. And people are now being warned, small businesses are being warned that if they put up these posters, they could be fined millions of dollars. I mean, it's just incredible, isn't it? I mean, we've reached a point where in a purported democracy, you can't actually just speak out anymore. But it's all being done in this way that makes it seem so good and squeaky clean and politically correct, because it's all about the environment, you know. And anyone who like puts up one of those nasty posters is just a terrible bad person who wants to, you know, drive an SUV and pollute, and must be just a terrible, you know, threat to humanity. So it's quite okay to just make those people pay, you know. Well, that's just totalitarianism. It is just the suppression of free speech. Now, on the ABC, Australian Broadcasting Corporation website here from yesterday, one of their top stories of the day, warning issued over anti-carbon tax posters. Labor is warning small businesses that they will risk these $1 million fines. And the coalition, of course, has sent the flyers to bakeries, butchers, dry cleaners and fruit shops just days before the carbon tax is due to take effect. Labor is warning businesses to be very, very careful about being part of the opposition leader's campaign by displaying the posters in their shop fronts. Very careful. I mean, what even does that mean? And why is it their position or right to tell people to be very careful about putting a poster up? I mean, what have we become? What has our country become? I just find this incredible. And this hopefully will be a spur to the population, to those who are not completely brainwashed or asleep, to realise, actually, we've got to redouble our efforts. We all have to put posters up. Every single house and business must put a poster up, and we need to have the posters on our T-shirts. We need to put the signs everywhere. We need to amplify the protest against this. And yes, force them to take us to court. Let's see if they can actually get away with this ridiculous idea of fining people for actually speaking out. Of course, the government is using the ruse that this is actually incorrect information, that is like, you know, businesses aren't allowed to put out information which gives invalid reasons for why they might put up their prices. So this is how the government is getting away with imposing these fines. You know, they're saying, well, you know, a butcher is going to put up his price of meat because of the carbon tax. Well, you know, he's not allowed to because the carbon tax doesn't affect a butcher. Well, see, that's not true. I mean, the carbon tax affects everyone because the price of everything is going up. It's that obvious. The price of electricity is going up. So if the price of electricity is going up, that means anyone who uses electricity is going to have extra costs. It's so obvious. I mean, we really are being, this is just insanity. This is just a doublethink exercise in idiocy. I can't even find words. I'm completely at a loss for words to describe how ridiculous the situation has become. And I wish I knew what to do. But what I do intend to do is I intend to take this to the streets. Truth News Radio is going to get out onto the streets. I'm going to be out there confronting the people, the architects of this, as well as talking to individual people. We're going to start getting more exposure, more video, and we're going to participate in whatever protests do occur. So just bear in mind, Australia is going into a extreme hyper-tyranny situation. Okay, let us move on again to the questions. Actually, I would like to play here for you a little clip. Let's see if we can get it up. I actually have, and this is again related to climate change, and I've just lined up a video here. Now, hopefully my producer in the background there will alert me if it's too soft or too loud. I'm actually going to just start playing it. It is an interview with Lord Monckton from the Rio conference, in which Lord Monckton actually talks about what was being the general atmosphere at that conference. So here we go. I'm just going to start rolling it.
It was a mad gig. And I use that phrase because I travelled here from Madrid, and the three-letter code for the airport there is MAD. Three-letter code for Rio de Janeiro Airport is GIG. And so my luggage tag on my suitcase said Mad Gig, and I thought how beautifully that summed up this conference of pointy heads here in Rio, which finished the day before we recorded this on the seafront here. Now, the extraordinary thing about this conference was just how many pointy heads there were supposed to be from around the world coming to it. The UN said that 50,000 were going to come. I guess that less than 10,000 actually turned up. I think this whole conference, right from the start, has had the stink of death upon it. The environment is no longer cool. It's no longer green. It's no longer fashionable, except among a few youthful ideologues and among the grasping capitalists, Marxist capitalists, if you like, of the green movement, who have made so much money, chiefly at taxpayers' expense, exploiting various so-called green issues. The week before this conference here in Rio, there was a preliminary conference organized by ICLEI, which is a group devoted to applying the principles of the 1992 Rio conference to local administrations and governments all around the world. And at that meeting, at which we had spies listening in, they were saying to each other, we can no longer talk about Agenda 21 in the context of the environment, because the environment, thanks to those wretched skeptics, has become a dirty word. It's no longer fashionable, it's no longer cool. We won't be able to win the argument if we talk about the environment anymore. We can't talk about climate change because even we have to admit it's not happening as they said. We can't talk about green issues because, frankly, in the West, the environment is largely quite well regulated altogether, and it's just been vastly overblown. They themselves were saying this. They were saying we cannot justify an environmental agenda, which is what Agenda 21 is supposed to be, in environmental terms. Now, this is an extraordinary admission. What they should have done, therefore, is to say we don't need Agenda 21. But, of course, they do need it. They need it just as the people here in Rio, who are at this conference, needed this environmental thing, because their real ambition has nothing whatever to do with the environment. I first learnt this when the late Eric Ellington, who was one of the founders of Greenpeace, who became quite a friend of mine and was a genuine environmentalist, nobody more non-political than he, told me that a couple of years after they had founded Greenpeace, they had all had to leave because they weren't politicians and they weren't political. They didn't know how to deal with the Marxists who, he said, had taken over the organization for purposes that clearly had nothing to do with the environment and were everything to do with destroying the economies of the West as fast as possible from within without a shot.
So that's just a summary there from Lord Monckton from that conference. Now, it sounds quite interesting that the movement within the climate change groups is starting to recognize that the climate change arguments themselves do not really hold the public's attention anymore, and that's largely because, you know, they've been found to be fraudulent. That's the real reason. But of course, they're going to rationalize it in other ways. And but of course, understand that the climate change is only one part of a much bigger plan from those who are the architects of Agenda 21, which is, of course, what they call sustainability and population control. Because back in the early 70s, that was the original threat, was considered to be population growth. So climate change simply became an effective vehicle for pushing that agenda, because, of course, CO2 is produced mainly by human activity. And, of course, the more people you have, the more CO2. And it looked like a tangible way then of saying, well, you know, here's the proof that we've got a problem. But as that's being now disproven, they're not going to veer from the path that they're committed to, because they don't want the planet to have this kind of flourishing of human civilization. They want the planet to be much reduced in terms of human population, and they, and I'm talking about the true architects of this, want a feudal oligarchical system to return for the planet, but a kind of a technological feudal oligarchical system. And so they will move to more and different agendas in order to achieve that. But I want to point out that this is intrinsic to, see, the elitist oligarchical way of running the world is the ancient system. We've talked about that a lot on this show. The ancient systems of civilization going back thousands of years all had this elitist oligarchical thing, right? And what's really interesting about history is when you look at the emergence of cultured civilization, it was always at times, like I'm talking about sciences, advances, really important technological and literary advances, always happened at times when freedom began to flourish, when the despotic power of this oligarchy was somewhat diminished, like in ancient Greece during the early classical period, and then in the Renaissance. These were the times when all the great things about human civilization were developed, during times of relative freedom. And I want to actually get back to discussing that, because that is why freedom is so important. Stay with us here on Truth News. Don't go away. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's good to have your company today. Now, I want to keep running through this argument that I was making before, and the point I was making is that the good things about civilization, the things that we say are the crowning glories of humanity, right? The great scientific advances, the great cultural things we've done, the advances in the way we organize society came about not as a result of some kind of top-down despotic control systems. Those were present, those existed, right? As human society evolved out of much more primitive forms of existence, hunter-gatherer type existence, and moved towards agriculture, you had, prior to that, of course, life was very difficult simply in order to survive. And of course, that imposed restrictions on people's freedom in itself. The difficulty of actually getting food, maintaining food, meant people didn't have free time, they didn't have leisure time to then develop more advanced technologies. But then there was a kind of a multiplying effect, kind of a snowball effect, that once you start, you then can increase. And in parallel with those developments, we started to see these more despotic, top-down control systems that developed within what they call the early civilizations. You know, we had like the god kings. We had people like the pharaohs and the Babylonian kings. And we had kind of almost slave societies. But when we look at periods in history when technology and science and philosophy have really flourished and really moved forwards, it was at times when there were relaxations of that despotic type system. And I'm thinking of the early Greek philosophers. Now, this was a time when the people who lived in the Greek islands had enough to eat, they were given some freedom, they were able to educate themselves, and they were able to actually just spend time thinking about the world. And this is incredibly important. This requires a bit of leisure time. You've actually got to be able to think about the world. And Greek philosophy is considered to be the foundation of modern science. It is essential to it because they just started speculating on things. They started asking questions like everything comes from water. They looked at the whole universe, and they tried to get an observational kind of system based on it. There was more. It was more practical than some of the more superstitious kind of mythological systems that the ancient Babylonian, Egyptian people had, which again were very much controlling that kind of a totalitarian system of their own. The Greeks were free to think, and they actually came up with a lot of original ideas, and that changed the world. The Greeks changed the world. Of course, the Romans came along. The Romans reverted back to that more brutal, more totalitarian system. Romans for a while had a democracy too and a republic, but then of course it was subverted. And of course, there were a lot of things that were completely wrong about all of those societies, including the rights of women and the fact that they did have slaves. We know all that. Look, it's never been perfect, but I'm only talking about relative improvements. You know, in the early Greek democracies, yes, there were slaves, but there were some people who had freedom. And that was so important. And later on, of course, we had the flourishing of science in the Renaissance period, which came on the wake of the freeing up from the Magna Carta onwards, and these new classes of people who had economic power imposed their need to have more freedoms. George, I know you've got a lot of thoughts on this. George, welcome back. We just had you offline there because we're having trouble with your mic. I do encourage you to keep that mic very close to your mouth, because we did have trouble with you in the last segment. But please continue.
Thanks. As you know, I'm not a great fan of psychology. I believe that much of it borders into the area of what I now call junk science. But if you have a look at Maslow's triangle there, at the bottom of it is physiological issues, and at the top of it, the peak, is self-attenuation, where a person reaches their peak. Now, in the bottom, you're concerned with food and shelter and the basic issues before you can become what they call self-attenuated, which is where you express yourself, which is where art and the realities of science and literature and good civilization, the development of the human condition evolve. So when those basic elements are under attack by being herded, and this could happen through government, through corporate manipulation. We've seen the inquisitions brought about from religious malthinking. We saw, to compare the Renaissance with, say, the inquisitional periods, where the Inquisition went to the point of attacking art. They attacked El Greco. He painted Christ with his head below certain other characters. The character was elongated. So El Greco was attacked. We saw other arguments where the world was supposed to be the center of the universe. It wasn't, and people were excommunicated. But of course, hundreds of years after they died, they were rehabilitated. So we find this absurdity. But genuinely, we need to be free. Free to think, free to organize ourselves, free to structure ourselves. From there, we develop the best. We develop literature. We develop our culture. We develop our realities, our true bondings. We develop science, art. We move forward. Under control, it just does not happen.
But George, within the global ecotechnic dictatorship that the architects of Agenda 21 would like to create, those freedoms will be curtailed because, as they say, we can't allow people to just do whatever they feel like. They've got to worship Gaia. They have to bow down before the goddess, as administered by the technocrats who will be in charge of that, who are kind of like the high priests. This, to me, just looks like the old Babylonian system that they want to bring back. There will be the high priests who serve Gaia, and you will have to be a slave to Gaia, but you will be told that it's for her good. You see, you will be propitiating the goddess. But there will be technology, but then the technology will only be to ensure that your behavior is restricted and constricted, and that everything that you do merely is a vehicle for the greater good.
Then we are really to blame for allowing that to take place. And if we allow those around us to bow down to that, then their stupidity and their herd mentality splashes onto us. We can see the difference. We know from our activities in the years of our lives that we are denounced. We might be messengers in some instance. We're trying to warn. We're trying to deliver some information. And we're demonized, criminalized, victimized, ostracized, lateralized. And we're attacked in general because people won't think. We find that education is not a way through. You can have some very educated fools. It's an issue of common sense, an issue of protection of freedoms. We do have rights. We exist. We're individuals. We argue about racism. We argue about religious freedom. The individual needs their rights. The individual needs their freedoms. And most certainly, whenever you've got a totalitarian administration, however that's come about through government, through corporate manipulation, through religion, our ability to think, our ability for our freedoms, our ability to live are destroyed, and that's bad. And everything that we do here, what we're discussing here, everything we think about, if we think about 9/11 or false flags, whatever we think about, it's to do with our freedoms being taken away, our human condition being adjusted. We don't need to do that. Whenever communities have succumbed to that, we know what the outcome has been through history. Germany's a striking example during the Second World War. So we don't need to do that. We must not do that. We must think. We must use our own intelligence. We must think. We must use our common sense. Education through the tertiary system these days, there's a lot of regurgitation involved. It doesn't teach us to have common sense. We need that separately. So a person who hasn't had the ability to be educated through a tertiary system, and those who have, we're all equal because we still have common sense, provided we use that, and we must fight to maintain our freedoms. We have to be always vigilant, and we've been told that through history from many people to maintain our vigilance. And whenever we slip on that, the outcome is exactly the same. And unfortunately, we're seeing that happen again today.
And of course, this was the position of the founders of the US Constitution.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That people had to constantly support and maintain their freedoms. You can't simply grant that power to an authority and say, protect our freedoms. Here, there you go. And we'll just now just do whatever you want. No, no. You've got to protect your freedom. Someone can't protect your freedoms for you.
No.
We're going to break in about 20 seconds. But the problem here is, I mean, look at what's going on with the American interventions. That's all based on this idea that we can go into a country and protect freedom in that country. We'll continue with that right after the break with Truth News Radio Australia. Please hang on with us. It's a great show.
The man who stole the water will swim forevermore, but he'll never reach the land on that golden shore. That faint white light will haunt his heart till his only memory lost in the dark. Dig a hole in the ground, straight down to hell, till there ain't no more water in the well, well, well. When you're down on your knees with nothing.
Welcome back to Truth News Radio. We've been talking here about the importance of freedom and the importance of actually protecting freedom. And, you know, part of that also is the importance of protecting truth. And because, you know, a lot of people get confused by that word because truth has a lot of meanings for people. Of course, the name of this show is Truth News. In some senses, some people believe truth is a religious thing and they believe that, you know, there is religious truth. And, of course, that is at a spiritual level quite real, and I don't dispute it. When we talk about truth, though, we really talk about something that's verifiable. And, you know, the famous example from 1984, you know, freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. That was in 1984. And the point there is, you know, the freedom is the freedom to tell the truth. So freedom and truth are very closely connected. But when we're talking about truth, we are talking about truth that can be verified through observation. And this is what we find, that as we start to lose freedom, we also start to lose the truth. These two things go together. And so in promoting truth on the show, we are also promoting freedom. What's your take on that, George?
Well, we have an innate passion for reality, which is actually truth. And when we're challenged on that, we stand back and object. If the story, I'll just go back to one that we're all aware of, if the story of 9/11 was told truthfully, we'd stand back. We would object to the protagonists there and what had taken place, but we were lied to there. We've been lied to in many ways at many times through history. We're defenders of reality. The climate change issue can't be proven. It's not real science. Someone next to you can't go along and demonstrate it the same and find the same outcome. Psychology has the same problems. Economics has the same problems, where you're starting with an end result and you're moving backwards. So we're defenders of truth. We're defenders of reality. We have a passion. We believe in the human condition. We believe in our innate intelligence, in our ability to associate. We don't want people attacking us. We don't want people stealing or injuring us because they've got problems. So we need a society that defends us against these elements, but not to the point of taking us over under the pretext of defending us. I don't want to be x-rayed going onto an aircraft. If the other fellow has box cutters, that should be either brought about through some other reason. I don't need to be x-rayed to be shown that I'm being protected. I'm creating a wasteful industry. This government concept creates wasteful industries and it drains on economy. Nothing productive is being produced here. It's like excess government. The money doesn't actually go anywhere. There's no asset. There's no value being produced. I can't see an infrastructure back. I can't see health, education and welfare coming back to me. I don't see that road being fixed or that dam being repaired. I don't see things. I don't see cheaper energy. I see big government. I see big waste. I'm being told that this is good for me. And it's not. It's not good for me. So our freedoms are being totally leached away by big government, which is in concert with big corporations. We see it in the construction of roads. We've seen it here in Australia, where one particular banking consortium approaches governments and will build this road and that road, and the government will buy it back or guarantee something. So effectively, this banking consortium runs around with bank guarantee documents. They discount those. They make money. The construction companies, whoever's invested in that project, build the roads. Then the government blocks the other roads or makes it more difficult to travel down those roads. So you're forced to use these particular roads.
Again, you just highlighted a point there again, is that this, on one level you could say, well, it's just an inefficient bureaucracy. They're doing their best. They're trying as hard as they can. Give them a break, George. You know, they want what's best, right? But what's interesting is that one of the effects of what they do with this so-called bumbling incompetence is that your freedoms get restricted. You can't even drive where you need to go because they've set it up to force you to go certain ways. Again, and there's also deception going on because there's all these rorts going on with all these people getting, you know, maybe backdoor deals, you know, getting and so monopoly capitalism, limiting people's freedom, deception and rorts with all the government programs. I think of that home insulation scheme, you know, where there are all these shonky companies that were just profiting from doing this absolutely fraudulent thing. Sometimes they weren't even installing the home insulation. Just for our listeners, this was a government scheme that was subsidizing people's homes to be insulated. And then, again, this is an Agenda 21 green thing, right? Because they were trying to make homes energy efficient, right? But what they did was the government subsidized it. And you got all these totally shonky companies coming in, and sometimes they weren't even doing anything. They were just getting the money from the government, didn't even put any insulation in. Other times, what's worse, they did it, but they did it in a really dangerous way. They were using nail guns on alfoil in the roof. Now, if you put a nail gun through alfoil in the roof of someone's house, sooner or later you're going to hit a live wire because houses have a lot of wiring. And this is what was happening. The nails were going through the alfoil into the live wire. The alfoil is electrically conductive. So you had situations where the entire attic area of someone's house was electrified. So if you touch it, you get electrocuted. But it also starts fires. You had fires and you had deaths as a result of that. So now we've got, as a result of this best intentions, unfortunate bumbling incompetence, we've got deception, we've got outright fraud, we've got restrictions on freedom, and we've got people being killed. It's incredible, isn't it? All the flow-through effects.
Let me give you an example that ties up a lot of what you're saying. In Bondi, and Bondi Junction, we've got a particular council there, the local government. Now, these matters are going back to some 60 years. Someone came up with a brilliant idea that the few shops in these shopping centres in those days needed to have parking allocated so that people could go and park somewhere in order to go to these shops. These are the days where the shops were fairly sparse and parking was fairly well in front of the door. There weren't that many cars. So the local council decided to levy all the shopkeepers a certain amount each year and each quarter to purchase by force properties in order to convert these to car parks. So someone's house down the street or some shop down on the far corner was purchased, and the property owners had to contribute towards this. So that was freely available. Then these started to aggregate. Then these in recent years were farmed out to parking companies. But of course, you got the first half hour free. Then these large tracts of vacant land used as car parks had a building permit attached to them where if this property was auctioned by a council, and they were allowed to do that, then you could buy attached to that purchase a building application that allowed you to construct more units on that land that would normally be approved. So, of course, they went for higher prices. So the councils would charge businesses to buy these land, these properties. The council would then make money from renting them out to car parking properties. These then in turn became big shopping centres, as we've seen in Bondi Junction, and also blocks of units, as we've seen in Bondi Junction again. So the councils kept bringing in money from various directions because of what they did. I would definitely call that a deception. I would call that some form of fraudulent activity, because this was a long-term plan. This had been worked out in advance. So councils were not acting to the economic benefit of the people there. We've seen that in Australia with energy now. There's going to be a further problem. Bolivia is an interesting argument, where the water supply of Bolivia was sold off to some American company. So it became illegal for people to collect water off their roof. There were some major issues in Bolivia to try and get this particular matter rectified. So it's government out of control. It's a mutation.
Now, in these examples you're citing, I mean, so who's actually benefiting in the end? It's these corporations, it's these companies that build the parking lots?
There's definitely a corporate involvement, and it's there's an army of corporate players who deal with government types on a daily basis. It would be a good idea if we built this road there. This is how we could do it, and this is how it would come about.
Yes, yes, yes.
And then we find a premier of a state retiring on a $10 million package from a banking consortium that was granted access to a contract for these roads. Then we find politicians in Australia and senior public servants giving speeches at $50,000 a hit in the US to almost empty rooms.
George, we're just winding up this segment. We've got one more segment to go. Thanks for that unusual bit of information there. You're with Truth News. Stay right with us. Love to have you today. Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Truth News Radio, broadcasting from Australia. Okay, I want to bring up a story here that is quite shocking. And George will no doubt have some things to say about it because it's very close to your research, George. The title of the article here from the Sydney Morning Herald, and this was actually published yesterday in the newspaper, "Scientific Evidence Flaws Highlighted." And you can Google that and get the story. Now, the story is related to a case. We're talking here about scientific evidence in criminal trials. The story is surrounding a case here of a man who was convicted and later acquitted based on the fact that there were serious failures in the use of scientific evidence in his trial. And one of the top forensic law authorities has now spoken out about this. Now, the case is of a man by the name of Jeffrey Gillam, and you can find out all about the details of that specific case, which I don't really want to get into. It was a family homicide, and the brother actually did the killing, but, you know, there were two brothers, and one brother ended up taking the rap, and it was really the other brother, and that's all quite complicated. But the point here is that the prosecutors and the police stitched this guy up because they wanted him to go down for it. Now, one of the top forensic law authorities has spoken out about this, and his name is the way this article is written, it's actually, they've written it in a very peculiar way, and I can't get the name easily unless I speed read through the article. I'm going to actually, yes, his name is Professor Edmund. And he has actually commented on this trial, and I'll just read to you some highlights. Among the flawed pieces of evidence were the opinions of three scientific authorities that there were similarities between clusters of stab wounds on the bodies of the victims. The judges concluded that not only were these opinions without scientific foundation, but prosecutors were aware that another expert had tested the claims and found they were incorrect. The prosecutor in the second trial did not call the expert either. There were two trials. The prosecutor in the second trial did not call Professor Cordner, who was the expert who had disputed the claims. Professor Edmund, the forensic expert, has said that this highlighted the fact that prosecutors were more focused on the capacity of forensic evidence to persuade a jury rather than on its actual validity. He said it revealed problems about the general use of scientific evidence because in many cases it is not based on peer-reviewed research. And this is a direct quote. He says, forensic techniques and evidence relied on routinely by investigators and prosecutors have never been assessed for their validity and reliability. Another quote, we have no idea if many of the techniques in routine use actually work or how accurate they are. Well, goodness me. I mean, you know, but on those TV shows, it looks like they know exactly what they're doing, and they the experts have these forensic techniques and they always get the bad guy because they know how to do it. George, what's going on?
Mate, you're not actually trying to suggest to me that these TV shows are not real, are you? You're not suggesting to me that what actually happens in the real world might be a little bit different.
Well, I mean, these TV shows, I mean, like, they're so real, you know, they're so convincing, you know, like the acting is really good, and like the costumes and everything, it looks very good. And, you know, in a lot of these shows, they even just convict people from profiling. You know, there was a whole fashion there of profiling that you can actually just, you know, someone did it because of the type of clothes they wear or the way they hold their head, yeah. Or, you know, or the way they write, all those little things. You know that they must have done it because that fits the profile. There was a whole fashion of that for a while. We don't hear so much of that anymore. But these more obscure forensic techniques, like in this particular one, it was stab wound clusters.
I'll tell you what is one of the most disturbing aspects of this. It's not necessarily, and it's significant, what occurred to Gillam, but it's a repeat performance. Now, not so many years ago, we had in Australia the AGAL, A-G-A-L, the Australian Government Analytical Laboratory. Their evidence was empirical. There is a famous appeal case called the Griffiths-Piggott-Simeon case, where these people were well enough supported to be able to destroy AGAL. It was shut down and rebadged because the two lead directors of AGAL, under some very intense evidence by some cross-examinations for some very determined and very honest barristers, came out after a period of time of this cross-examination and admitted that it was often the case that police knew a person was guilty but didn't actually have the evidence.
Because they just have this psychic ability.
Of course. So this, of course, was provided by AGAL. So it was goodbye, AGAL. Now, we see in the Gillam case, we see a rehashing of that. Many years ago in Australia, in criminal prosecution, we had the police prosecution branch. Now, I won't go into the details of that, but you could imagine what would happen when the police were conducting their own prosecutions in court, in criminal matters. That had to be put to rest. It became the DPP, each state and federally. The Departments of Public Prosecutions were formed. And now we see that the same culture seems to have infiltrated or infected, should I say, in these areas. It shouldn't be an instance of convincing a jury or what do they believe. It should be a matter of real evidence, real fact. So what are we told when, through herd media, we're brought to believe that there isn't a systemic failure? And I'm not making this one up. The phrase systemic failure actually came up in that court case with Gillam.
As well. And how long ago was that?
The Gillam case, that's the repeal just recently.
Oh, this one's systemic, but in the other one you quoted, that was systemic as well.
Well, it certainly was when the laboratory was shut down. But we saw in the FBI laboratory in Washington, I believe, some number of years ago, there was a lead story. Time magazine broke a story concerning a manager there. I think her name was Graham, I'm not quite sure, where there were also situations of evidence being provided. And, of course, there was a very famous white-collar crime case in Australia about a decade ago where the lead solicitor, the lawyer, made a most stunning statement. He said, "We don't know what he's done, but we know he's done something wrong.
He's been naughty."
Well,
see, they just know, like mummy knows when you've done something naughty, because they can tell that you're lying.
Yes, which brings about the failures of body language. Now we're being told through positive psychology that if a person stares at you, as they're saying, whatever they're saying to you, it's not an indication of truth, but an indication of they're wondering, do you believe what I'm telling you? So now we're totally lost. We don't know what to believe anymore.
Have you heard about these secret techniques that the CIA allegedly have to use micro facial gestures to determine if someone's lying?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with that?
Come through in, it's an advance on body language called clustering. And that goes through into other areas. But I think it's just an expression of what's in your mind at the time, where you're looking, NLP, the six areas that you're looking at, where you're standing, when you're saying something. These are all aspects of person trying to determine whether you're real or not. But it's not really. It's no substance involved there.
It's a hocus pocus, really. It's a voodoo sort of act.
Yeah, it's...
It probably does work in some cases. And probably the more you know about a person, the more you can get what their typical profile is and you can see if they're changing from it. But if you don't even know someone, you can't just apply a global... system, because everyone's different and everyone will have different things that maybe indicate when they are lying that they can't hide, but you really have to know that person individually.
You have to establish what they call a baseline.
Yeah.
And it's the movements away from this particular baseline that's that affects. But psychology is notorious for trying to put people into boxes, and you've got some extraordinary situations in jail, and you know I've done a lot of research in jail.
Oh, indeed,
system,
indeed.
And where a situation that an officer could walk into a cell and say, "This cell is not clean.
Yes,
I'm going to charge you." You have internal jail charges, but these affect your ability for parole and such, and your conditions in jail. So your cell is not clean. I want you to sign off on this charge. Well, you have a right to have that heard by a magistrate or a judge, but of course you don't bother because you might get harassed further. So people sign off on these. So your cell is dirty, according to what someone says. If your cell is dirty, you're not maintaining personal hygiene.
That now becomes a fact. And this is very interesting, the way assertions become facts when they're uttered by certain people.
Yeah.
And you've alluded to this before in court. If something is said in court, it then becomes fact. Even if it actually has no evidence, because it was said in court, it becomes fact. Same with the prison guard. Prison guard says your cell is dirty. It may not be dirty, but because he said it, it is now recorded. It now becomes fact.
Yes.
And this is just the pseudo-reality unfolding, isn't it?
So that's right. And you're, as a prisoner, obliged to sign off on it. It's under duress, of course, is not an issue. So you sign off, okay, the cell was dirty. And that mutates to failing to maintain personal hygiene. Failing to maintain personal hygiene then mutates to a high risk of self-harm. And that, of course, mutates into other problems in the jail system. And these prisoners are wondering, what the hell happened here?
George, we're just running to the end. We're just running to the end of the hour. I just really want to emphasize that the quote here from the expert is that forensic techniques that are relied on routinely have never been assessed for their validity and reliability. Never been assessed. Not only are they not proven, they've never even been assessed, and we have no idea if they work. So if you do find yourself coming up against the Department of Public Prosecutions, watch out, because they can stitch you up. You basically don't have a chance. If they want to get you, they're going to get you. And this little story was actually on page 3. It was a tiny little story. Anyway, we've run out of time. It's been a fantastic show. George, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you very much. Look forward to seeing you again.
We'll be back next week. See you then. I'm Herewood Fenton, over and out from Truth News Radio Australia.